In his second inaugural address in January 2025, President Donald Trump declared that America will soon be greater, stronger, and far more exceptional than ever before. Since returning to the White House, the president appears to have been in a hurry to turn this pledge into reality. Over the last 14 months, his administration has unleashed a flurry of foreign policy initiatives around the world. Sweeping new tariffs have been used to put pressure on allies and adversaries alike. Controversies over Ukraine and Greenland have introduced tensions into the transatlantic alliance. And US military strikes in Venezuela and Iran have delivered a dramatic shock to the international system. So what are the forces driving US foreign policy under Trump's second presidency? Has his political outlook evolved since his first administration? And how is Trump seeking to transform America's role in the international order? I'm Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. With me to discuss what is driving Trump 2.0 is Brendan Sims, professor of the history of international relations at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to the podcast, Brendan.
Hello, thank you for asking me.
Now, Brendan, our discussion today is prompted by your recent essay for Engelsberg Ideas, entitled What Drives Trump 2.0? In the article, you provide a brilliant, sweeping account of President Trump's foreign policy during his second term. But in order to do that, you also venture back to his first term and the early 1980s. Can you just explain what you were attempting to do in this essay?
Yes, what I was trying to do was really to follow in the footsteps of Henry Kissinger's celebrated dictum, quote, that the convictions that leaders have formed before reaching high office are the intellectual capital they will consume as long as they continue in office. So I thought, and indeed my colleague Charlie Lederman, with whom I wrote a book on Donald Trump's worldview, which came out in early 2017, we thought that in order to understand Trump and the way in which he would behave, you really need to understand the era and the context within which his principal geopolitical attitudes were formed.
And why were the 1980s such a formative moment for Trump? What were the debates in the atmosphere like at the time?
Well, I think it's important to draw a distinction between what was salient at the time and what was important to Trump. So at the time, we were in the height of the Second Cold War. We had a Reagan administration which was spending a lot of money on defense. We had allies of the United States which were spending less money on defense. And we had a threat from the Soviet Union. But you also had challenges to the American position in the Middle East, and in particular, challenges around the supply of oil from the Middle East, all very contemporary topics, of course, relevant to today. And what we found interesting in our book is the fact that unlike most critics or supporters of the Reagan administration, Donald Trump didn't really take issue with the question of whether or not the administration was too hard or too soft on communism. He basically had nothing to say on the Soviet Union and communism, which is highly unusual given the fact that that was the main issue in the Cold War, whichever side you're on. Instead, Donald Trump's view was that the main problem was that the United States was essentially picking up the tab for the defense of her allies, was being done over, and these allies, because they didn't have to spend their money on defense, were able to take advantage, as he put it, of the United States economically. So somewhat unusually, he spent most of his time, and some might say he still spends most of his time, not criticizing the enemies of the United States, but essentially attacking its allies.
And you do mention that from a very early point, Trump has this fixation with America's friends rather than with her enemies. And this almost comes to a fever pitch during the 1987 tanker war in the Persian Gulf, which is obviously somewhat ironic because of what is currently happening in the world. Can you just tell us why the tanker war matters so much to him?
So the tanker war arose essentially out of the Iran-Iraq war and the fact that the Iraqis were attacking the Iranian oil production and oil export facilities. And the Iranians in retaliation were attacking not merely the Iraqis, but essentially also tankers passing through the Gulf to put pressure, as indeed is the case today. on the West, essentially to lean on Iraq. And Trump's view was that the passage through the Straits of Hormuz, the supply of this oil, which mainly, of course, went to American allies rather than the United States itself. So it went, in those days particularly, it went to Europe and to Japan specifically. And Trump's view was essentially that the provision of security in the Gulf was a public good, which the United States was providing, and its allies were benefiting from this, but were not themselves contributing to it. And this was compounded, in his view, by the fact that these allies then in turn were besting the United States economically. So in his famous, some would say infamous, letter to the New York Times, he criticized this and he said, and I quote, "The world is laughing at America's politicians as we protect ships we don't own, carrying oil we don't need, destined for allies who won't help." So this is said, you know, just under 40 years ago. And it is extraordinary that we are now in a very, very similar situation in the Gulf today.
So you could say that there is, in some ways, a remarkable inner consistency to Trump's convictions.
You could definitely say that. He has formed a worldview in the 1980s from which he has hardly deviated. Of course, the irony is that Trump, the president, is now in exactly the position that he was criticizing Ronald Reagan for being in the mid to late 1980s, which of course explains his extreme anger and criticism towards the allies today.
So how did Trump's worldview translate into policy during his first term as president of the United States? What were the key features of his foreign policy in those years?
So in some ways, what happened after his inauguration in 2017 arose out of these long-standing policy positions. So he immediately began to put pressure on the NATO allies to increase their defense expenditure, which, by the way, in my opinion, was entirely justified. That critique was entirely reasonable. The NATO allies were, with the exception of the United Kingdom and a number of other countries, were nowhere near the 2% of GDP they were supposed to be spending on defense. So he ramped up the pressure there. He began to criticize the allies on their trading policies. He changed really the discourse on the People's Republic of China, which had supplanted Japan in his demonology. So if in the 1980s he'd been attacking Japan as the country which was taking advantage of the United States economically, then really since about 2010, he'd been targeting the People's Republic of China. So for Japan, really read China. He also unilaterally abrogated the deal, the Iran deal, the JCPOA, which was a deal to essentially limit Iran's nuclear ambitions, which was not merely a deal with Iran, but also involved some of the major European players. All of that really unsurprising, given his previous positions, given his longstanding hostility to Iran. However, there were some curious new elements. For example, his preoccupation with North Korea and its nuclear program, which hadn't really featured before, as far as we are aware. And secondly, what seemed at the time even the very odd demand for the United States to buy Greenland, which didn't really go anywhere in 2019, but was first put on the agenda, and of course pretended what was later to come.
Now, you open your essay with a very striking quote from Talleyrand, the French statesman, who said of the restored Bourbon dynasty in 1815 that they had learned and forgotten nothing. What lessons did Trump himself take from his first presidency, in your view?
Well, I think he just felt that he had been constrained by the machine, by the bureaucracy. It's well known that he appointed as his principal ministers, advisors, quite strong figures, people like General Mattis as defense secretary, people like H.R. McMaster as national security advisor. So these were quite strong personalities and in a way constrained him in important respects. I mean, they were very robust on issues to do with the Russian threat, issues to do with the People's Republic of China. But they were not encouraging him, for example, to demand or attack Greenland. And I think he felt coming out of that, and I think a large part of the base felt that that constraint needed to be removed. So probably if he carried anything over from the first term, it was the idea that he should be less limited, that he should be able to let rip, basically, on the international scene, which, of course, is what he's done.
So there's an important difference in the personnel surrounding the president in this second administration. What do you think are the other key continuities and differences between Trump's first time in the Oval Office and his second administration?
Well, everything is more accentuated. Everything is more radical. So the demand for Greenland was articulated in a much more aggressive manner. A new element also is his focus on the Western Hemisphere, which didn't really focus, it didn't really feature much in his first administration, with the exception of Greenland. But it has been, was trailed quite heavily in the national security strategy of December 2025. It listed as the priorities homeland defense and the Western Hemisphere. And so we've had the interest not merely in Greenland, also the what we might loosely call the trolling of Canada, the suggestion that Canada should become the 51st state, which is more or less seriously intended, but it has certainly antagonized the Canadians. You've got huge pressure put on Mexico, one of the reasons why the Mexicans swooped down on one of those drug lords recently. Big pressure on Panama to essentially extrude the PRC. Big pressure building on Cuba, which may well be the next target here. And of course, the spectacular snatching of President Maduro from Venezuela. These are all things which you could see to a certain extent. I mean, there were tensions with Venezuela in the first administration, but there was nothing like the focus on the Western Hemisphere that we've seen over the last year.
And what explains this new emphasis on the Western Hemisphere? Is this just long overdue geopolitical housekeeping, or is there something else motivating it?
I think it's a confluence of two things, which are actually of long-standing concern. One is migration. Migration stroke drugs. So the concern with the Western Hemisphere is partly driven by that. And the other is, of course, fear of Chinese penetration, which has greatly increased in that part of the world, even since Trump was last president. So I mentioned Panama already. There's also the question of a major port on the Peruvian coast. There are many other examples. I mean, China is actually the biggest trading partner of many countries in South America now. So I think if you put those two factors together, you get a pretty good idea why the Western Hemisphere is now so important.
So Trump has this new muscular emphasis on security in the Western Hemisphere, the Donroe Doctrine, if you will. But you are skeptical of claims that Trump is seeking to divide the world into spheres of influence where different great powers can exercise their own influence. Could you explain why you disagree with that interpretation?
Yes, so this argument has often been made, and it comes out of two aspects, really, of what we're talking about. One is the said Donroe Doctrine, the focus on the Western Hemisphere, and the other is what appears to be a not only a distancing from Europe and a skepticism about Ukraine or the Ukrainian cause, which is definitely there, but what also appears to be some kind of possible mega deal, high-level deal, partition of the world with the other great powers, in particular Russia's Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping in China, of course, and perhaps Narendra Modi in India. And the reason why I don't think that is what is happening is that there is really nothing in the Donroe Doctrine and the way in which Trump has been behaving to suggest that this is in line with the original Monroe Doctrine. The original Monroe Doctrine, as articulated by President Monroe in 1823, essentially involved not merely the idea that the United States would focus on the Western Hemisphere, would not allow any additional European colonies, but also that the United States essentially would hold back from interfering in Europe, in the old continent. Now, there's absolutely no suggestion on the side of Donald Trump that he has any intention of holding back in any part of the world. So the Western Hemisphere is a kind of a springboard, if you like. He definitely wants to keep other powers out. However, and this is in a way the good news for Europe, I don't see any signs that he's going to be prepared to let anybody else dominate other parts of the world. And we've seen this in his policy in the Middle East, most spectacularly, of course. No sign of retreating from there, despite some predictions that that might be the case. But also in Europe, there is no sign that he is abandoning Ukraine completely, is continuing to provide intelligence support. He actually ramped up pressure until very recently on Russia with respect to oil sanctions, which were much severer than those originally imposed by Biden administration and by the Europeans. And of course, there's no sign that he's abandoning the Japanese and the Taiwanese and the South Koreans in East Asia, although there are concerns, it has to be said, in all three places that that might happen. But doesn't appear to be happening. So Trump, and I think this is also psychologically important, Trump doesn't really accept any other gods next to him. So I think the kind of deal, which I think Vladimir Putin would dearly like, some such partition of the world, I just don't think that's possible. In fact, Putin has suffered heavily at Trump's hands. I mean, you just have to look at the destroyed Russian air defense systems in Venezuela. Just look at the collapse of the Russian ally in Syria. Just look at what's happening to Iran, which, of course, is a Russian ally, and so on and so forth.
So how exactly is Trump seeking to transform the international system and the United States' position within it? You describe what he's doing as an attempt to establish a new kind of American tributary system, or a global Platzer Accord. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this means and what this system might look like?
Yes, essentially the Platzer Accords in 1985 involved increased exchange rate for currencies like the yen to improve the United States' economic competitiveness. And that was a kind of economic rebalancing. And obviously what Trump is trying to do is to create a similar system by which the United States is put through tariffs and other measures in a better position economically, and also that the burdens of defense, as he sees it, are shared more equitably in the way in which he interprets that phrase. I mean, I think his view of what is equitable may be debatable, but it's certainly the case that the United States has been paying over the odds and that many partners, particularly NATO and others in East Asia have until recently at least, not been doing enough. So that's really the kind of rebalancing that he conceives. I call it a tributary system, which is a phrase which rattles around quite a lot with respect to the United States nowadays. It's a phrase that really comes from the history of China, which had a tributary system until the onset of Western imperialism. I call it a tributary system simply because it goes beyond a kind of an alliance of not quite of equals, but of people on some kind of courteous relationship to something which is more submissive. If you look at the way in which Donald Trump treats his allies, it's certainly very hierarchical. Of course, the relationship is inherently hierarchical because the United States is so powerful and the rest of us are, relatively speaking, so weak. But the way in which Donald Trump is trying to recast this is inherently top-down.
And where does this leave the notion of the United States being, in some senses, an empire by invitation in Europe and elsewhere? Does Trump's vision of a tributary system spell the end of this model, or is it consistent with it? You know, is he merely changing the terms of the invitation, or has he ripped it up entirely?
Well, I think he is changing the terms in the way that I've outlined. It's, however, still the case that we in Europe are maintaining that invitation. We have not withdrawn the invitation. So in fact, you know, in many ways, we're even more determined now, more concerned to keep the Americans focused on our continent. So there may be a cultural, intellectual, even aesthetic disenchantment with Donald Trump, which is not hard to share and to imagine. But in terms of our security needs, our security dependency, that is as great as it ever was. So there's no sense that we're withdrawing the invitation. And what we're really most worried about is not so much that he would be interested in us, but rather that he would not be interested in us. You know, there's only one thing worse than Donald Trump focusing on you. It's him not focusing on you.
And that leads quite nicely onto another point that I wanted to ask you about. You identify a number of paradoxes and ironies in your piece, and that's one of the delights of it. One of these Trumpian paradoxes that you identify is in the president's relationship with Europe. He and his administration have this relationship whereby they are at once severely critical of European elites, in one sense, but also highly invested in a certain idea, perhaps an idealized vision of European civilization. And what does this idealization of Europe mean for the future of the continent's relations with the United States?
Well, I think it makes it at one level inherently problematic because there is a divide across the Atlantic, which has always existed in various forms, but is stronger now than ever before. It is to some extent, obviously cultural, ideological, but at the same time, it is also true that just as there are many people in the United States who sympathize with, as it were, the European mainstream, so there are very many people on this side of the Atlantic who actually sympathize with Donald Trump and with the MAGA movement. And one can think of Viktor Orban, one can think of the National Rally in France, one can think of the AfD, one can think of many, many groups, and not just those, who have some sympathy with the cultural stall set out by J.D. Vance in his famous speech to the Munich Security Conference in February 2025, and in a sense reprised by Secretary of State Marco Rubio in February of this year. So it brings its tensions, but it also means that we are, in that sense, closer intertwined than ever before. There is no sense that that part of America is letting us go. It is actually engaging with us. It is embracing with us ever more closely. And of course, that is one of the things that is so uncomfortable. But it does mean that they are still here with us. So, you know, it's swings and roundabouts.
Now, I know that historians can be reluctant to act as prophets, but I thought I might just ask you for a few reflections on the future. Obviously, part of the issue for America's allies is that the Trump administration does have this kind of hectoring approach when it comes to allies. And certain policies, such as Trump's willingness to build a rapprochement with Russia over Ukraine, attempts to coerce Denmark over Greenland, have all placed severe strains on America's traditional alliances. I just wanted to ask you, do you foresee any scenario whereby this heavy-handed approach in Europe, but perhaps also in Asia, might backfire or undermine his broader project to reshape the international system?
Well, it is in a sense already backfiring, and we're seeing this in the controversy over the Straits of Hormuz, because we're seeing a situation where Western allies are refusing to participate in the opera so far to participate in the operation to reopen the Straits, because they simply have no faith in his strategy. They don't even know what his strategy is. I don't know what his strategy is. He prides himself on playing his cards close to his chest, and that may work well at certain times and in certain circumstances. But you do reach then a point where people become exasperated. And if at the same time you wind down your military aid as opposed to military supplies in Ukraine, which are now being paid for by the Europeans, and if your intelligence support, which continues, is also a two-way street because you profit from the information the Ukrainians are giving you to improve your data sets and your targeting systems, then that means you've got less leverage over these allies who are becoming ever more skeptical. So I think Donald Trump, you know, if one were to put this in terms that he might use and would understand. He's in a kind of a bind, because on the one hand, he has put massive pressure on the Europeans and indeed forced them to do something they should have done for a long time ago, which was to increase their defense expenditure. So he has stepped up investment, so that's good at one level. On the other hand, in the way that you've described, he has damaged the brand through his policies, through his wayward behavior and rhetoric. So where does that leave the share price of Donald Trump and of the Western Alliance? If I knew the answer to that, I would be a lot richer than I am as a humble academic.
And we've obviously seen various Western leaders going to China as well to try and balance their relationships with the United States, with Beijing. Do you think we are going to see a Western order that might fragment slightly, and as other countries decide to build closer bonds with China?
I think there is a risk of that. Of course, it was already the case before Donald Trump came to power the second time, before his second administration, that certain European countries, particularly France and indeed Germany under Chancellor Scholz, were continuing to pursue the relationship with the PRC. So that was already the case. But of course, the recent policies of Donald Trump have increased the pressure or the inclination to find alternatives. I mean, if you're going to be hit with American tariffs in that way, then you're obviously going to be less chary about having a relationship with China. If you're Mark Carney and you're being literally pressurized with regard to your own independence, then you're going to start playing these cards. So I think there is some risk, but I think we've also been there before. We've overcome those challenges. And I think in the end, the dependency, as I said earlier, on the United States militarily is still so large that we're talking about fluctuations within certain bands, but not, I think, a fundamental shift, at least not yet.
And finally, I'd like to touch briefly on a big potential challenge that's looming on the horizon for Trump 2.0, and that is the midterm elections that are coming up in November this year. If President Trump were to lose the Republican majority in one or both houses of Congress, would that have a restraining effect on his foreign policy?
I think it would. For one thing, there are certain initiatives in foreign policy that you can only undertake with congressional support, treaties, for example, also funding projects for particular activities. The other risk is that a hostile Congress, and this might include disaffected Republicans, could quite easily introduce legislation that tied his hands on Ukraine. You could quite easily imagine something like a Ukraine Relations Act, which would be, say, modeled on the Taiwan Relations Act, which basically forced the president not to abandon Ukraine, to take Ukrainian interests into account, perhaps to increase aid to Ukraine, and so on. You could envisage such a bill being pushed through Congress, a little bit like the lifting of the arms embargo against the Bosnian government was achieved in July 1995, forcing President Clinton at the time to engage more directly in the Bosnian conflict and actually to bring the Bosnian Serbs to heel. So definitely large losses in the midterms will tie his hands quite considerably.
And in the longer term, do you think that this Trumpian moment in US foreign policy will recede? Or are we dealing with a fundamentally new trajectory in America's relations with allies and the world that will ultimately transcend party divides and Trump himself?
I think that the best way of looking at this is to look at what happened in the Biden administration, because of course he was in many ways very different to Trump. Yet on key policy positions, in particular the kind of friend-shoring or home-shoring of industry, the focus on the PRC's industrial threat, but also the general move against China across the board. These were things that Biden actually continued. So one can quite easily imagine that President Trump's successor, assuming he allows the successor, of course, to take office, You could easily imagine that successor carrying on important policies of Trump. And I think in general, the idea that the Americans will continue to subsidize European defense in the way that they have historically, I think that idea is in any case, across the board, no longer really sustainable in American politics.
Brendan, thank you very much.
Thank you.